Welcome again to the Cannabis Investing Podcast, where we speak with C-level executives, scientists, and law and sector experts to provide actionable investment insights and the context with which to understand the burgeoning cannabis industry. I'm your host, Rena Sherbel. Hi again, everybody. Welcome back to the show, episode 2 of SPAC Week, part 2. And today we're talking to Chris DeMuth Jr., a SPAC superstar. He runs his own Seeking Alpha Marketplace service called Sifting the World, which covers SPACs and event-driven research. He founded his own hedge fund called Rangeley Capital, which also covers SPACs and event-driven investment opportunities. A really great person to talk to. He talks to us today about what to look for in SPACs, the SPAC world in general, the spate of SPACs in the cannabis sector in particular, his favorites in that area and in general, why he likes Canada over the US. Yes, you heard that correctly. Why Aphria is his biggest holding, their recent deal with Tilray. We get into lots of great stuff. And don't forget, tomorrow we have Michael Orbach catching us up with the parent company and also Subversive Real Estate's recent deal with Intercure. Don't forget that. We'll talk to you then. Before we begin, a brief disclaimer. Nothing on this podcast should be taken as investment advice of any sort. I am Long Trulieve, Chiron, Isracan Biosciences, the parent company, and Air Strategies. You can subscribe to us on Libsyn, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Play, and Stitcher. Chris, welcome to the Cannabis Investing Podcast. Thrilled to have you on. So thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So for anybody who reads your stuff on Seeking Alpha, who follows your marketplace service, knows that you bring a certain intellect and humor to your thoughts and your analysis, which I really appreciate. We've been talking for a while before I hit record. That's been evidenced even more so. So I'm really happy to have you on, and I'd love for you to tell listeners how you started Rangeley, how you started focusing on SPACs, and what brought you here today.
Sure. Well, so my background was in risk analysis, specifically political risk analysis for hedge funds, for prop desks at banks, and for a while, oil and gas companies as well. So internationally, I would look at what countries offer political risk. And then in Washington, I would look at what regulatory agencies offer risk to specific investments. I started managing capital after that job. I started Rangeley a little over a decade ago, and we are value investors. We're interested in underpaying. We're interested in doing deep dive research and analysis, and we're especially interested in structural anomalies where the price system doesn't really seem to catch up because of some kind of corporate transaction or quirk where the counterparty is generally constrained. We like to be buying when somebody has to sell something or selling when somebody has to buy it.
So we're focusing on cannabis mostly, but talk to me in general about like the SPAC space in general. Right now, it's obvious, you know, getting huge amount of press and a lot of investors are interested, and there's certainly a huge spate of SPACs. What's your view on kind of the overwhelming number of the SPACs? And then how do you kind of narrow it down, and what do you look for when you're looking for SPACs in general?
Well, having gone for 9 years, where if you mention this, somebody would have no follow-up questions. Now you have, so you've had no conversations that anybody wants to be in about SPACs for 9 years. And then 1 year where you try to have a conversation and then 10 other people are trying to have the same conversation at the same time. You think, where have you people been this whole time? You know, it's kind of like if you've had years of no dates and then you have 10 dates and you think, geez, you know, if you could have spaced this out, this would have been a little more convenient on my side of this. But it's nice that people care all of a sudden. There's a lot of very sloppy language about the current level of interest in SPACs. A lot of people saying it is a bubble, a lot of kind of cranky tut-tutting about it. Andrew Ross Sorkin in the New York Times today, a writer I admire, a person I like and know, is certainly in this category. I am just as cranky, and I'm just as skeptical of financial innovation. But if you look bigger picture, we have fewer publicly traded securities than we did 10 and 20 and 30 years ago. This is just chipping back slightly. So people who are used to the public markets are seeing a whole category of behavior that was typical of venture capital for a very long time, including very successful venture capitalists, and that's simply moving into the public market.
It's interesting that you say that because I feel kind of similar to the cannabis space. I feel like a lot of people are cranky about the cannabis space as well. And then boom, you know, I kind of feel like it's just Biden getting elected and, you know, all bets are off. And now all the cranky people are a little bit happier. And it's interesting how that happens, right? Like nothing's been talked about or people are very down in cannabis. And then one thing happens and boom, and it's kind of like a domino effect.
I think there was kind of there's kind of a confluence of events. Biden's certainly part of it, but that has I think tipped the debate kind of I think past the point of no return. And I think in part because there are kind of so many disparate interests that have really come together around this one. But was it fast.
Yeah, absolutely. Yes, there's definitely like other factors involved, but I agree that was the tipping point that I feel like really, really made it mainstream in a way that I think even kind of the improvement of the financials and companies wasn't doing. So it's definitely been interesting to see. So what are kind of like the criteria? What are the concrete things that you're looking for in a SPAC?
So we like to be very deeply engaged with the sponsor. We look to be at the very beginning. So kind of even before they file an S1, we like to have a good communication to really understand as much as we can about what the sponsor is looking for. Ideally, we're talking about a very experienced team that has good operational competence, good deal-making experience, and it's helpful if they have kind of an ability to market their ideas to the capital markets. The advantage to me of SPACs versus kind of the predecessor traditional IPO is that it's all market-driven. So we are both thinking a lot about what we like, but also paying a lot of attention to the market cues. So if a sponsor is able to go out and raise a big SPAC, that's something that all else being equal, we'd prefer a big one than a small one. The very smallest ones create the new problem of a company that's kind of too small for the public market sometimes. We like people who we've worked with before. So, you know, if we've had a very good experience as an investor and people are happy working with us, the SPACs with Roman numerals are all else being equal nice to invest in. We either like broad mandates or mandates that we think would be a good fit for available companies. So we're aware of the intended sector, but at the same time, those intended sectors have no legal teeth. So you can always switch at the last minute what you're doing. We like people that are being opportunistic. And we like when we have an opportunity to participate in all parts of the capital structure. So we might have founder shares, we might have a significant stake in the IPO offering. I typically like to be 10% ideally of a SPAC IPO. And then we want to be available to have a conversation when they find a deal to participate in a PIPE, in a private investment in public equity. And so it's not a certainty that it will like it, but it is a certainty that we want to have the conversation. So we want to be deeply engaged with an experienced team, and ideally a fairly large SPAC is much more helpful to us. It doesn't take that much more work to have a $500 million SPAC where you're putting a significant amount of capital in than it takes for a $100 million SPAC. So $500 million all else being equal is better.
And then in terms of the cannabis SPACs in particular, you said that you like the big SPACs and the ones that can really like make a mark and with that quality management. We've seen some of those come to market in the cannabis space. The parent company is one. Air Strategies started as a SPAC. They come to mind. There's a number of them that I feel like have done that. I've also talked to a couple people that have, you know, kind of Michael Orbach being one of them who's coming from the parent company. And he was saying that he feels like all these cannabis SPACs that are coming out now, not all of them are going to stay cannabis SPACs. There's just not enough quality worthy companies to pick up for them to kind of stay above water. Do you have an opinion there?
Yeah, I think that one of the best things about a SPAC is the reactiveness to the market and opportunities that they can pivot, that they don't have to stay in some channel. I mean, one of the things that I'm always very sensitive to is how much of behavior is arbitrary because of some fixed audience or fixed rule, or how much of it is rational. People trying to be rational and self-seeking make mistakes all the time, but at least it's kind of an honest mistake, as opposed to getting stuck in something where you know it's not going to work. We had one, a Canadian one, Bespoke, that was set up as a cannabis SPAC that then did a wine deal instead. Now, the irony is this year is that cannabis is an extremely top performing sector right now. And so if you can find something that has a real business purpose, I think that that's ideal. I mean, of all of the different cannabis SPACs, and there's a pretty big handful that we've been involved in, a Silver Spike Acquisition Corp has something I particularly like. It was a good team, a good size. They did this deal with WM Holding, a weed map that was a real business. So, I mean, they are de-SPACing something that I think is part of the progression from cannabis being a kind of hobby gray market to the dove gray market to the white market. And in that progression, you need to kind of formalize a lot of the things about the business structure. And so I think that that's a super exciting deal. And that's also one that happily they have another Silver Spike Acquisition Corp 2 coming up that is something that we're going to hopefully be very involved in as well. So that was my favorite of the group. But there've been a number of really good ones. I think that some leave, like Bespoke, is fine. You could see others come. You could see others that are not even raising money as cannabis SPACs that simply see the business opportunity. I think that there's going to be a sea change once things are 100% legal, decriminalized, and at all levels of the government. So not just at the state level, but once you have federal intervention pulled back and agencies that have been very harassing of this industry pull back. I think one of the things that the existing cannabis companies are going to have to deal with is Altria and all of the companies that are simply going to wait completely until the illegal prohibitions are gone and then able to jump in with Marlboro Greens and with all of the infrastructure in place to compete very aggressively with all but the most efficient companies.
I want to get back to that point because it's a point, I've talked to a few people about it and I'm interested to talk more about that. But sticking for a second on the pivoting in the space. So for instance, Bespoke, does that change your thesis at all? I know you were bullish on them. Does it change your thesis when they did the wine deal?
Yeah. One thing we love about SPACs is the trust value always gives us kind of an out. I think that that was one that underwent a number of changes. The management changed. They changed from Canada to the U.S. And then changed their industry. One of the sensitivities I have about SPACs is as they get to the end of their timeline, there can always be a kind of sense of urgency that can verge on desperation to kind of flail around. And so, we like SPACs that can act decisively and quickly, not just because it ties up my money for a much shorter period of time if you're doing a deal in 6 months than in 2 years, but it's also indicative of a kind of team that's on offense that knows what they want, that's kind of going for something specifically, and they don't have that activity bias where you have often personally at risk a high seven-figure amount of money that if you don't use it, you lose it. And so when the alternative is no deal and losing your at-risk capital, the incentive to do any deal is high. And that's not a condemnation of what they're doing, but a concern.
And the Silver Spike SPAC too that you mentioned, they're mm-hmm. also wanting to get into cannabis again. That's for cannabis as well?
Yes. Yeah. Silver Spike 2 is one I'm super excited about. It's $250 million. The same team has won. And when you have this enormous rush of activity, one of the things that makes my life easier is just reputations. If you've done all the work to, you know, symmetrically, so they know who we are in some cases, and we know who they are, and we've done our due diligence, boy, put a Roman numeral on it, raise another $250 million, and we can kind of plug and play our view on the team. And the fact that one was extremely successful is, you know, really means that we can kind of jump right in and reuse the views that we had from the last one. I mean, and Silver Spike One's trading at, last traded at, you know, $25, over $25 just per share. And if you think about that, how these units work, it kind of understates the performance a little bit, because, you know, from the IPO, the units had a share and a half of a warrant. So that's been an extremely good investment by a team that has a lot of theoretical credibility in my mind, but the practical credibility of, you know, getting a three bagger in a short period of time on a recent investment is one where, you know, a lot of investors turn to their next one with enthusiasm. So, I think that that's a particularly good one.
Something else, I listened to your podcast. You were just on Alpha Trader on Seeking Alpha. Seeking Alpha really loves Chris DeMuth. And you were mentioning something that I've experienced, which is people getting into SPACs and then like a day or two later being like, what's going on? Nothing's happening, you know? And you were saying that that's like an entertainment and it's not necessarily investing. And I'm experiencing that very much. We had, as I mentioned, the parent company, and kind of every day I get a message from somebody, why isn't it doing what I want? And I was like, this is investing. This, we're not trading, you know, this is investing. I'd love for you to like, you speak about that and what your thoughts there are.
We're analysts of companies, and we think about companies as owners because we are owners, but exactly in the category of your house or your vehicle or anything else you own. If you glance at Zillow every year, that's kind of normal. If you glance at it several times a day, that would get at some point kind of weird. I mean, maybe you look at it aspirationally and other things you could think about, but, you know, how's your house doing this morning? It's a question that not only do I not know the answer to, but it doesn't even make sense. It's something I own. I bought it when I wanted to buy it. I'll sell it when I want to sell it. I feel completely responsible to take seriously my purchase. I take very seriously my decision to sell, but I'm not like just some dude in a bathrobe in his mom's basement whipping it around on a Wednesday morning. Like, I don't care. I don't know anything about it. It's not analyzable. It's not important what he's doing on Robinhood. It's just not a useful thing to think about when you're trying to think about things that are important and that you can do something about. If I can put tens of millions of dollars with a free put in the form of the trust value and a free call in the form of a warrant with a team that I like and their experience and it's worked twice or three times in the past, I know to say yes, please. And on the way out, when we're done, when it's kind of trading in the market as a public company after de-SPACing, we know when our opportunity cost requires that we shift our focus. But the kind of fintertainment, finance entertainment kind of is, stupid, and I think it's dangerous, and people should look for their entertainment elsewhere. But it's a big role, especially I think with free trades, especially during the pandemic where people don't have the same outlets in sports and gambling. I think it fits that need. And I also think the just generally in society, maybe most predominantly with younger males, you have the role of kind of risk-taking monkey dancing as part of what somebody does. You know, am I going to get in this bar fight or not? Is she going to want to go out on a date with me or not? And not just the fight and not just the date, but the anxiety and excitement of that unknown risk, I think has this big role in society, and kind of little kind of micro outlets of letting off steam is a lot of what people are looking for. And I think they're kind of losing their minds sitting at home with free money from the government to kind of try some weird outlets for that kind of risk-taking desire. And so I think that that really pushes people to the de-SPAC equities where there's something exciting to talk about. You know, there's a slide deck, there's a exciting, often aspirational business. And one thing about SPACs as opposed to IPOs is that they can actually market their out-year performance. So we're talking about what is the total addressable market and what is the earnings in 2030? Obviously an absurd question. Nobody has any idea. I have no idea. They have no idea. It's not knowable. But that's a fun topic. The earlier kind of pre-deal SPAC doesn't really have much to talk about. So even if it's a spectacular investment where you're risking nothing or risking pennies to potentially make dollars, a day goes by, another day goes by, and you're almost guaranteed a few months of boredom. That is not a problem for me, but I think it does come up with a lot of the kind of retail investor kind of enthusiastic about this that likes to wait for the SPAC itself to announce a deal.
And getting back to your point before about how, you know, companies like Altria are going to be able to move in once it's federally legal. Mm-hmm. So this is something that I've kind of been thinking about. We started this podcast about a year and a half ago, and this was like a question that I would think about myself and ask people, but what about when it gets legal? Like all these companies are going to come in and they're going to usurp the power that you've already like, you know, made for, you know, brought for yourself, created for yourself. And I think the more I talk to these executives, especially the good ones, I mean, I would say maybe only the good ones or the great ones, they would say that the kind of the first mover advantage and the kind of place that they've put on the map and the expertise that they've built and the team that they've built and the brand that they've built, that that's going to be more valuable than a huge market cap. What are your thoughts there?
Well, I'm an investor in some of their companies. I hope they're right. I would say that the economics of cannabis with no regulatory compliance problems is a very different market. Horticulturally, it's not a particularly hard plant to grow. So if you could fly over the Midwest from the East Coast to West Coast and look down and see the big circles kind of filled with cannabis out in the open, and kind of our agricultural efficiency is so high and the distribution and kind of organizational efficiency of a company like Altria is so high, that is a big caveat for me in this industry and something I'm paying a lot of attention to. I think culturally, the funny thing is a lot of people who are drawn to cannabis are also people who are drawn away from tobacco. Like it's not a big cultural overlap. So were I at Altria, I would probably want to have a very distinct kind of branding and cultural awareness of this market. And maybe that hurts them more than I'm thinking, but as a potential entrant, and they're the name I just use as kind of the generic big American corporate entrant, that when it's 99% legal, they're going to be 0% in it. But that gives you no indication of what happens when it goes from 99 to 100. A lot of the people who are willing to kind of slip into a light gray market are, you know, you can't do that if you're a big company. But I think the world's going to change dramatically in the next couple of years. At the national level in the U.S. at least, as it becomes legal, I hope and expect. But it's something, you know, we have some big investments in this area, and it's something that we think about probably every day. AFRI is my largest by far cannabis company, certainly outside of the world of SPACs. And, you know, kind of thinking about that company, thinking about cannabis in general, I think the awareness of how competition could change in the next couple of years is something that is on my mind a lot.
Yeah, I mean, as we've seen, as evidenced by like the Aphria Tilray deal, that already changed the Canadian landscape. The other point I would make, though, is that the changes, like even if what you're saying does come to fruition, it's kind of years down the road, because even a federal legalization, it's going to take time for that to be implemented. It's going to take time for that to be understood and the companies to. So it is far out any way you slice it, I think. So talk to me about Aphria. Why is that your biggest holding, and why Canada? Why not the U.S.?
So biggest holding within cannabis.
Yeah.
You know, well, a number of reasons. Right now, it's an incredibly interesting deal with Tilray. If you own Tilray, and I might write about this at some point today, sell your Tilray and buy Aphria instead. I mean, the deal value. I mean, it's I think it's a little bit like we were talking about in SPACs, that there's this low level of interest in the pre-deal SPACs, and then it explodes when they announce a deal. Even if they announce a deal that's kind of quite like well projected, we've looked at things where we've been very involved where there was even like a letter of intent out, and that was simply formalized, and the date it was formalized, the equity goes up 50%. So the market's not doing its proper discounting mechanism job. In this case, Tilray is a popular, well-known proxy for cannabis. So somebody who simply wants cannabis exposure will often just buy Tilray. Often, you know, a market order on Robinhood is TLRY, not Aphria. Well, the value of Aphria in the deal, it's a stock deal. There's no collar mechanism that changes it. I mean, Aphria is Tilray as per the deal getting closed. I think it's going to close by August. The spread is almost $23 a share. The value of Aphria in the deal is about $52 a share right now. So it's this incredible return. I mean, the IRR is over 100% just owning it between now and August. No promise on how the spread closes. I think it's quite likely that it does. They've already gotten antitrust approval in the U.S. They need some approvals in Germany and Canada. They need shareholder approvals, but that should all be forthcoming over the next few months. It can close all sorts of different ways. Tilray could go down, Aphria could go up. They could be some combination of the two. But if you stipulate the Tilray price, Aphria is a better investment. If you own Tilray, boy, I can't think of a good argument for not selling it to buy Aphria instead.
Yeah, it's really funny how that's a proxy for the cannabis market. And it's just really, I think for people that think that Tilray is a proxy for the cannabis market, keep listening to this podcast. Why do you prefer the Canadian kind of global model to the American one?
I think they're a little ahead on the regulatory policy front. It's a smaller market. I think it can be kind of a laboratory a little bit there. But a lot of my interest is related to this deal. I think this is going to be a very, very good deal for Aphria. And by the way, there's a comment that I might get from this podcast, but I often get from commenters. Aphria is the target from an accounting perspective, right? So there's always a funny situation when there's a merger, one company's bigger, one company's smaller, but the successor company in terms of what the stock will be is TLRY. So I always think about Aphria as the target, even though whenever I say that, I get pushback that in terms of who's the management and so forth. The management doesn't matter when you think about it from the arbitrage spend perspective. We have investments in both. I think that Canada so far has been a bit ahead, but at the same time, the U.S. for some not particularly attractive reasons is going to just have to move forward. You know, we have a half dozen states that are basically broke at this point. I live in one of them, but Connecticut, New York, New Jersey, Illinois, California, one thing about them is they're out of money. They're going to do whatever it takes over the next 24, 36 months to maximize whatever they can tax. They're going to tax. They kind of have to. And those states, the five I just mentioned and a few others, are going to be very influential at the federal level. I mean, there's advantages to divided government and advantages to unified government. But in this case, the unified government happens to be the same party that is represented by each of those states. And they're going to need help pushing as many industries as possible into the white market that is also the taxed market. And so I think that's almost inevitable. I don't know that they have many choices at this point. And so I think that's going to accrue to the benefit of gaming and cannabis in particular.
Interesting. So do you see it in the U.S.? Like, are you betting on some players, or do you see it more wide open in terms of what you were mentioning before, in terms of it could be that the players only reach a certain point and then the kind of bigger players from other sectors come in?
Sure. I think that kind of U.S. Cannabis, I think the silver spike, the two silver spikes where we have one business already announced and then another will have a lot of optionality. You know, I love the SPAC structure, but I love the optionality and flexibility of being able to kind of pick and choose the battles, you know, especially raising capital right now, the idea of $250 million to go hunting over the next 2 years. Well, this is going to be the critical 2 years in the history of the cannabis industry. And so being able to do that with fresh capital, I think is super exciting. I think we'll have a lot of good picks. And you know, we'll be able to take from there, because a lot of the best ways to play at this point are private. A lot of the best ways to play at this point historically would have all gone to the benefit of angel investors and venture capitalists, and now retail public market investors are going to be able to participate via Silver Spike.
And do you see the next year as kind of consolidation is happening already? Do you see it as being deals that we're going to be really surprised by as entities merging or being acquired? Do you think there's...
Absolutely. And I think it's going to be offensive maybe in the early part of the cycle, and then it's going to be defensive on the latter. You know, if they realize if your edge is a willingness to early on break the law or to be flexible or to have an all cash business, you have no competition from a Fortune 500 company. Having no competition from the Fortune 500 company and having major competition is all the difference in the world. And so I think there's going to be defensive M&A kind of in the out years, you know, as that really changes. One thing about kind of the highly aspirational businesses, and you see this in a lot of SPAC announcements that talk about the total addressable market, you see this idea, this kind of Oz, and you're approaching it and you picture you being the one to exploit it. And I'm always thinking, you know, there are other people who like money and they like their kids better than they like your kids. They can see all the things you're seeing. There's no promise that you get any particular significant market share in this total addressable market, even if you're right and you probably have no idea. So I think that kind of this influx of competition is going to be a real thing. I think there's going to be a ton of deals defensively, if not offensively, as people kind of brace for the Altrias of the world and the other big competitors coming in as this becomes mainstream and corporate.
And do you see an option of one of these kind of consolidated entities rising to the level of a Fortune 500 company?
I would hate to be accused of talking my book, but I think that the Afria combination is probably, you know, one of them, just in terms of scale and recognition, ability to raise more capital down the road. I think that's a part of it. I think that plus some of the bigger SPACs are kind of where I'd look. And then both on the branding side from the current incumbents and the potential entrants, it's just going to come down to kind of hitting the community of customers in the way they want to be addressed. So I don't think this is going to be a Altria advertising on the Super Bowl next year kind of super corporate look. I think that would be counterproductive and fail. And so both sides are going to kind of angle for kind of who can represent better the people they're trying to appeal to, and is there some kind of cultural connection to the companies that were there kind of circa 2020 and 2021 versus the ones who jump in over the next few years?
Right. I think it's going to be really interesting to see how it plays out. I think it's also going to depend on like what happens in the states. How successful is this legalization process? What happened? Is it a state by state? Does the U.S. federally legalize? Does that usurp? You know, I think that kind of all those different details play a part in figuring out where we're going to be and what we're going to be looking at. Do you think in terms of like opening the cross-border commerce in terms of cannabis, do you think that like spreads it wide open and then you can talk about opening global borders? How do you see kind of that part of it opening up?
I think it's very promising. I think that the kind of grubby reason that it's being addressed now in part is the state fiscal problems I mentioned. But the importance at this point of opening borders and having kind of some kind of cohesive policy moves together really speaks to one of the dramatic, dangerous, deadly failures of the drug war itself, which is not just prohibition, but regulatory arbitrages when you're dealing with something like cannabis is extremely perverse. Even dealing with tobacco, state-level taxation is extremely bad. When you talk about people who are willing to break the law, an 18-wheeler full of Marlboros shipped from North Carolina to New York City is worth millions in profit, and you can have some of the worst people and the worst, most dangerous enemies of our country simply arbitraging state differences in a legal but regulated and expensively taxed product. And so I think that's a disaster just related to tobacco. If you open that up to cannabis, not only are you going to have really tragic consequences of illegality and of smuggling, but it's really going to hurt the industry and besmirch the cannabis industry if you have a lot of that illegality. The nice thing about markets is make it legal, make it cohesive across the country. The issue to me on cannabis is like they should have good disclosure, just like any kind of FTC look at a company should be telling the truth about what they're selling. But as long as they're telling the truth to customers, it should be as even as possible to get rid of the regulatory arbitrage and get rid of criminality. The drug war was almost designed in the laboratory to maximally profit people who were willing to commit crimes and violence. And the inverse shouldn't increase that by increasing regulatory arbitrages. The inverse should be openness, transparency, something that I'm sensitive to and could be done very badly.
Yeah, it's kind of absurd how crazy that it can be and how much that it's not being figured out now. I live in Israel we're kind of seeing it in fits and starts. We've had this legal medical market, but the adult use, they can't figure it out. And there's so much playing both sides of the legal, illegal market here. And I know that's happening too in the States to some degree. I think it's probably in some ways still happening even in Canada to some degree. And I think that it's just, I can't figure out why, like, as you were saying, these bankrupt or nearing bankrupt states, why they can't figure out how to make this work. But here we are. So I'm hopeful that it changes, but I wonder how it does, or I wonder how fast it does. What do you think the kind of holdup is in terms of cannabis? How much do you think that affects the investment community? Like, we've seen institutional capital starting to trickle in to cannabis, maybe more than trickle in lately. Do you feel like all these unknowables are still affecting the investment community to a degree? Or do you think for the most part, people with a mind in their brain are kind of realizing that this is a maturing, if not mature, sector?
Oh, I think that the early parts of the market are really dominated by moms and pops and kind of small organizations that are kind of organic and in some ways don't have a lot to lose. Once you deal with large investment institutions, you're dealing with individuals and institutions with a ton to lose, and so have been extremely pedantic about steering clear. And I think it's just going to become quickly mainstream. And I think the whole culture around it will change very quickly, will kind of tip. And so I think that you're going to have, even in the past few years, you've had investors that have even had problems being held up at the border between the US and Canada between two jurisdictions where what they were doing was completely legal, a province and a state. But it's simply the moment they crossed between two things that were fine, there was harassment. So I think if your downside is so protected that you just need to do nothing but follow all the rules in a large organization where you're well compensated, the risk aversion is almost complete. So I think that there's a lot of interest on the investor side, on the corporate side, that will flood in when that last 1% is pulled back. It's interesting though, because I think in some ways, corporate America has been underappreciated as a progressive force. I think that if you look at the civil rights era in the 1960s, it was a progressive force in the American South. If you look at kind of racist rules around busing, the bus companies were against them. It was not something that was the kind of a political progressive force versus business. Business was on the right side of a lot of the early civil rights movement. In my mind, it was a progressive force around marriage equality, which I think is another example of just a lightning fast tipping point where something was controversial. And then not only did it change, but it almost flipped where the controversy would be being against something that was controversial for being for 5 minutes earlier. And I think that some of those kind of social changes and the pace of the change and the urgency and the role of business being a force for change could come again with cannabis. I think the IRS is one of the institutions that's been kind of a vigilant cold warrior to the last minute, and having tax complexities around anything to do with cannabis and having it be largely a cash business where there are very, very few financial institutions. Interestingly, mostly credit unions and mutuals that are willing to transact at all. I think that that's something that is going to prevent the most conservative institutions from doing anything to the last minute. So I think going from 99% to 100% is going to be a flood of differences, both on the investor side and the corporate side.
Yeah, it's a really interesting point. And I think that's dead on, that how much business has been a force of good change, and specifically with the cannabis sector. I think It's many of these businesses that are having these social equity components that are really changing the face of so many people's opportunities within the space. I think it's been very impressive. I'm curious, you're a thoughtful finance guy. What are some of the books that you've read to bring you where you are now? I'd love to hear from you, like one or two books that kind of made an impression on you.
Sure. So, and I actually, for a while in Seeking Alpha, I actually had a series just called Kristen Meath Jr.'s Library that, getting fairly old now, but they're certainly the books that were the most kind of formative for me. It has an embarrassing title because it sounds like a get-rich-quick scheme, but Joel Greenblatt, who is somebody who I like and admire, we've played poker together in the past, and he's a kind of champion of school reform and other issues in New York. But Joel Greenblatt's You Can Be a Stock Market Genius is the one that really caught me up on the idea of event-driven and special investing, where instead of just going out in the world and say, hey, what's a good value, you look for an event that is likely to obfuscate. And so you don't wake up saying, what's a value? You wake up and say, where could value be hidden? What is that one tick of complexity that really hides value? So that's the one. I'm interested. Super Forecasters, Philip Tetlock, is one that I think is really good about the very humbling topic of prediction. That's one that I love that book, kind of learned a lot from. And it's also interesting to see around the world, people who have very, very good abilities, prognosticating abilities, aren't necessarily the people you think of, that they're kind of these anomalous kind of stories of people who are very good at that. So those are two that I'd throw out that have been kind of important to me. Two of my favorite books, two that I hand out to investors and potential investors when people visit the office. Those are my common party favors. We have wine party favors and book party favors, and they usually get one of each, and those are two of the books that they often get.
That's awesome. Chris, this has been such a great conversation, and thanks for being such an integral part of Seeking Alpha's community and bringing so much light and insight into listeners. Thank you so much for joining us today. Is there anything you want to leave listeners with before we go?
Like Charlie says when Warren asks him, I have nothing to add.
Does that make me Warren?
Yeah, it makes you Warren.
Chris, really, it was a pleasure. Thank you so much, and I hope to talk to you again soon.
Thank you so much.
Thanks so much for listening to the Cannabis Investing Podcast. Subscribe or follow us on Seeking Alpha, Libsyn, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Play, or Stitcher. And we'd really appreciate it if you could leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. It helps other investors find our show. If you have feedback or questions, we'd love to hear from you at RENAPOD@SeekingAlpha.com. That's RENAPOD@SeekingAlpha.com. Thanks so much for listening, and see you next time.